All right, welcome everybody. We are now doing our Parsha class on Parshas Vayishlach. The title is Keep Your Friends Close and Your Enemies Closer. We begin with a video about the recent Israel-Gaza escalation after the IDF assassinated Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader Baha Abu el-Atta. So let's go to the video. This will bring everybody up to date. I will supplement that as we go on.
On Israel, dozens intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. One direct strike on a house in Netivot, one strike on a factory in Sderot, and one terrifying impact on the highway that narrowly missed the cars. In just the last minute, a new red alert siren in Netiv Asara on the Gaza border. Since dawn, rocket sirens have been heard as far as Tel Aviv and Modi'in. 1 million children stayed at home as schools were cancelled, Tel Aviv and south. And in a rare step, workplaces were also ordered closed by the Home Front Command. Tonight, incoming Defense Minister Naftali Bennett declared an emergency situation within 80 kilometers of the Gaza Strip, including Tel Aviv and the capital, Jerusalem. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Israel does not want an escalation, but it might take some time until the situation calms down again. Islamic Jihad's message to Israel tonight, you started it. But you won't decide when this ends. Middle East correspondent Adi Koplovitz brings us more on the terrorist whose assassination sparked this latest round of fighting.
In a fundamentalist environment surrounded by Islamic extremists, he managed to stand out. Until this morning, Baha Abu el-Atta was the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades, the military branch of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad organization. Just one out of several positions he filled in the terror organization. Abu el-Atta is considered to be behind some of the major attacks on Israel in the last 6 months. Those include the launch of 700 rockets from the Gaza Strip just before the Eurovision Festival in May, the rocket targeting a music festival in Sderot last August, and the rocket that targeted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during an election campaign rally in September. Recently, Abu el-Atta's name has been appearing repeatedly in Israeli media, the man responsible for disturbing the fragile calm between Israel and the Gaza Strip. His organization acts on its own, refusing to coordinate attacks with Hamas and trying to scuttle any negotiations with Israel. It's safe to assume that, whatever they say in public, his death will not be mourned by the Hamas leadership. They have had to pay the price for his itchy trigger finger. But el-Atta even ignored the main Islamic Jihad leadership in launching his attacks. He had his own independent policy and was considered almost impossible to control. El-Atta tried more than once to drag Israel into war. Ironically, with his death, he may have finally succeeded.
Okay. All right, so this is from literally a month ago, November 13th. All right, so let's go to the... You guys see the sheet? Scott, you see the sheet?
Yes.
Great. Yeah.
All right, good. All right, so let's continue. All right, so why did Israel target Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader Baha Abu el-Atta? Apparently, they delivered a missile into where he and his wife were sleeping. It was very rather targeted. Nobody else, or they died, but it was fairly targeted. Why'd they do that?
Why wouldn't they do that?
I think they said that he was like in imminent final stages of launching like a new attack, right?
Well, you could argue that, like as Esther saying, that basically any time they might have a number of these, or the answer to that question really is obviously a military secret, okay? So I don't have the definitive answer. One point is that they could have a number of Islamic leaders of these various groups, and if they get some intelligence where they know where the guy's going to be, they'll blow him up. You know what I'm saying? It could have been just now. That's one possibility. Second possibility is that no, they don't just kill all Islamic, all terrorist leaders at any given time. There could be additional factors in the consideration. One is that there may have been some movement, some positive movement between Israel and Hamas. you know, to calm things down between Gaza and Israel. And this dude is leading, is not even listening to his own leadership outside the Strip, the Gaza Strip, and causing more attacks, you know, shooting rockets. And he's basically, in other words, he's a loose cannon. Yeah. So once they had the opportunity, and basically they could then just deal with Hamas and not be able to have to deal with any other factor. You know what I'm saying? Just consolidate your terrorists into one group, and then you can deal with them. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, he's a threat to Israel. And it's not like they didn't target anyone else, any civilians.
Correct. I mean, the question is, let's say they had an opportunity to kill Nasrallah. Who's the head of Hezbollah in...
Nasrallah moves like all the time, right?
Yeah, he doesn't sleep in. He doesn't sleep in bed twice.
That they would if they could, but there's a reason why all his speeches are done by, like, you know, by phone or video conference. Like, he's never at these rallies in southern Lebanon.
Right. So the question is there a rule that if you can get Hassan Nasrallah, you get him? One possibility. All right. And therefore, they had Baha Abu El Atta. They just went for it. Or they sometimes will have a reason not to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Right. They do, you know.
There's more than one calculation. Let's give you one more calculation.
Right.
All right. And so when they assassinated him on the morning of November the 12th or 13th, what was Islamic Jihad's response?
Well, they launched a whole bunch of rockets, and then Hamas essentially, I don't think they did anything because they didn't want to, like,
so they did make about it like 190 rockets, about 200 rockets, and Hamas did nothing. Why do you think that was?
Because they're not stupid. They didn't want to get into a full-scale war with Israel.
That's one reason. What other reason?
They didn't like him either.
Exactly.
Right.
In other words, this guy, they were happy that this guy's a competitor. In other words,
Israel did him a favor. Got rid of a guy, and Hamas gets to be like, oh no, but yeah, good riddance. But it wasn't our fault.
Exactly. He was a thorn in their side. They're trying to consolidate power over the Gaza Strip. This dude's chucking rockets, creating unrest on the border, and they can't control this guy. Now they're in control. You know what I'm saying? So they get to call all the shots, which is the way they like it. All right. Now here's the question that people say: if you're living in Sderot, which is, you know, not that far away from the border, obviously a question that you may think about, and quite frankly, people in the south of Israel think about all the time, is why doesn't Israel go into Gaza, take it over, and defeat Hamas and Islamic Jihad once and for all?
It would be, well, I mean, we already were there. We don't want to go back. We're trying to create peace, right?
Okay, and but it hasn't really, you know.
It hasn't worked out.
It hasn't worked out so well.
Well, and that's kind of like a last resort kind of thing, because.
All right, Scott, let me have some other people.
Sorry.
Let's say Emily. Let me pick on some other people. Emily, what do you say, Emily? Why didn't the IDF go in there and take over and eliminate Hamas and Islamic Jihad from the Gaza Strip?
I mean, provoked or not provoked, I think that there's still like a limit to the type of action and what the reaction will be. So if taking out a leader in a smaller organization will have less resistance and also be forward on the path, and maybe something like that is more strategic than simply clearing out an area.
Correct. In other words, there's heavy for Israel to invade Gaza, which has, by the way, do you know how many Palestinians live in Gaza? You want to hazard a guess?
2 million?
2 million? Correct, Scott. 2 million, there are 2 million, citizens of Gaza who are, who don't like, who do not like Jews. So if they take it over, and you're talking about, they'll be, it will be very costly in money. It'll be very costly in Jewish, in Israeli boys' lives who will be killed. And to me, and then you're gonna have to run that society where everybody hates your guts. So it's just a disaster. That's why they left. So it's better to deal with and try to minimize the rockets and the tunnels than what? Than to try to do a full scale invasion. You know what I mean? All right. Next question to you guys. If Islamic Jihad has over 12,000 rockets in Gaza, why do they only shoot 200 in Israel? Hmm. Anyone want to guess?
You got to keep them. They're hard to smuggle in.
All right, so if your leader gets assassinated, why are you only shooting 200?
I think it depends if they're trying to accomplish something versus make a statement.
That's a good point. So go ahead. So by sending 200, by shooting 200, they were and causing terrorism and misery in Israel. They're expressing their displeasure or their anger at the assassination of their leader. But they still want to keep the rockets to fight another day. But they're not. If they shoot all the rockets, they got nothing left. So they're not done yet. They're, you know, and they felt there was not time to quote unquote kind of go to war with Islamic Jihad. All right, let's continue on. Now we're going to shift into our parsha here. Take a look at this. I'd like to read this this statement from the Midrash. Who can read it? All right, Suzanne, read it out.
The Midrash Rabbah relates that before Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi would travel to Rome to visit Antonius, he would study Parsha Vayishlach beforehand. Once it happened that he did not study Parsha Vayishlach prior to his trip, when that mission was unsuccessful.
Okay. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, what's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's claim to fame? Who is he? Other than being a why is he a famous rabbi?
He wrote the Mishnah.
I don't know if he wrote the Mishnah. He was certainly the editor in chief. He was the the editor. He put it together. But correct. So he's around the year 180, 200. And that's the common era. So this was the Jews in Israel during that time were under the occupation of the Roman Empire, right? And he would have to go with a delegation to Rome to, you know, deal with issues, how the Romans are treating the Jewish people who are living in the land of Israel. So before he would go, he'd read this week's Parsha about the encounter of Yaakov and Esau. He said, the Midrash brings down that one time he did not review the Midrash, he did not review the Parsha between the encounter of Yaakov and Esau. That mission was unsuccessful. So what does that tell you? What's going on? Why? What's up with that?
Hmm.
Why is that relevant?
Maybe the Parsha instructs how to travel and, you know, how to travel and when you intersect with an enemy or, you know, like a foreign nation or your brother.
Correct. Who is Esav? What's another name for Esav? Esav has another name. Anybody know? It's referred to as Edom. He gets that name Edom, meaning literally red one, after he had he said, Halitainam and Adom Adom Azeh. Give me some of that red stuff. Okay, back at the selling of the birthright. All right?
Didn't he come out of the womb red as well?
Yeah, well, they called him Asa from the word Asu, made, complete. In other words, he was already dressed. He was very hairy for his age. And therefore, he was called Asa, which is a play on word of, and the word Asa means to make. So he's like sort of made. He's a made man. That's what Asa means literally. So that's his first name he was called. And then the next name is Edom. Now, Edom is also a term used for Rome. It's that Rome are viewed as ideologically the children of Esav, not the biological children of Esav, but the ideological of Esav. Therefore, by studying this episode of the encounter of Yaakov with Esav, you're in fact exploring the best way to handle and deal with a formidable foe. Okay? So let's get into the actual story here. Let me have who can see it well and read it. Any volunteers?
If you tell me what verse it is, I can.
Okay, so it's 32:4.
Oh, the beginning. Okay. And Jacob sent angels ahead of him to Esau his brother, to the land of Seir, to the field of Edom. He charged them, saying, "Thus shall you say to my lord to Esau, so said your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and have lingered until now. I have acquired oxen and donkeys, flocks, servants, and maid servants, and am sending to tell my lord to find favor in your eyes. But how long should I go for?"
You want to go on?
The angels returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother, to Esau. Moreover, he is heading toward you, and 400 men are with him." Jacob became very frightened, and it distressed him. So he divided the people with him, and the flocks, cattle, and camels into two camps. For he said, "If Esau comes to the one camp and strikes it down, then the remaining camp shall survive."
Okay, good. Stop right there. All right, so let's focus on the first thing. What was the strategy you see in Yaakov's first communication to Esau? All right, in other words, we're trying to learn from Yaakov how he's handling a very difficult situation. So what's his strategy of dealing with, you know, what do you see how he handles the first communication? There are a number of things there. What part of his strategy in his first communication with his brother?
So he's reaching out proactively before he actually goes there, for one. And then
number one, correct.
Trying to like preface what he's acquired and what he's doing and what that he's trying to gain favor.
How is he trying to gain favor in the eyes of Esau?
He shows that he's stayed away from, like, until now, and then he's acquired all of these things.
Well, how's that going to make Esav like him anymore?
If he sees that he's, like, a good person trying to serve God.
Well, you didn't mention God at all here.
And also, I don't think
why would Esav care? Is that something that Esav would care about? So first of all, number one, Why doesn't he go speak to himself? Why is he sending a messenger?
Because he doesn't want to get killed.
Yeah, he doesn't want to get killed. So first of all, he needed somebody to go to sort of take his brother's temperature to see how he's doing, number one. Number two, does he allow his messenger to say whatever he wants?
No.
No, he has a very specific talking point, right? And his talking point is, and notice the language, to my Lord Asa, your humble servant Yaakov says, I've been staying with Lavan, and I've been delayed until now. And I've acquired cattle, donkey, sheep, slaves, slave girls, and I'm sending my word to tell my Lord to gain favor in your eyes. What is he trying to do?
He's trying to make his love. Sorry.
Yeah, one at a time. Erica?
Okay, he's trying to make Esau feel more like empowered that he has the upper hand than him.
Correct. He is, because basically Esau's anger was that Yaakov had stole, in his eyes, the birthright and the blessing. And the blessing was that you're going to be the leader. You're going to get all the benefits. You're going to have all the material benefits. But what is Yaakov basically telling him? No, you're the man. You're the Lord. I'm the servant. Number one. Number two, I came back with some goodies, and I'm trying to go find favor in your eyes. So what is he communicating with Asa? I'm here, and I'm going to come to you, and I'm going to try to make it up to you by giving you stuff, right? That's why he's talking about what he has. He has what to make him happy. Okay? Now, how'd that go? Emily, how did that go? How did that plan go? Was that a success?
It didn't work.
Did not work. How do you know?
So Esau's response was to come towards Jacob with an army of 400 men.
Yeah, that's not good. Because if he's still trying to make peace, he would have come with like a couple people, right? Just like an entourage, not a proverbial SEAL Team 6. And how do Yaakov feel when your brother's coming to visit you with a SEAL Team 6 of sort of platoon?
Pretty scared. He's pretty scared.
Yes, very scared. Because basically, Yaakov does not have an army with him. And what's his military? How does he prepare for war? What's his strategy for war?
Divide and hide.
Right. Divide the camp in two. Well, what is that? How does that work? How does that help?
It gives them chances. At least not everybody will be in one place, and when they get attacked, some people will survive.
Correct. Scott is correct. In other words, basically, if Asa attacks Group A, then Group B can like run for the hills. Run! Exactly. So that's all he can do is at least do what they call damage control. He cannot do an active battle plan. All right. Let's read these psukim. The next psukim, start with verse 14. Anybody else want to read? All right, Suzanne, you
after
read.
After spent.
Oh, sorry. Who just read that? Emily?
Oh, I can start.
You gotta start.
Okay. After spending the night there, he selected a tribute for his brother Esau from what he had with him. The tribute consisted of 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 nursing camels with their young, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys. These he gave to his servants, each herd by itself. He said to his servants, "Go on ahead of me, keep a space between one herd and the next." He gave the first group instructions. When my brother Esau encounters you, he will ask, "To whom do you belong? Where are you going? Who owns all that is with you?" You must reply, "It belongs to your servant Jacob. It is a tribute to my master Esau. Jacob himself is right behind us." He gave similar instructions to the second group, to the third, and to all who went after the herd. "You must all say the same thing to Esau when you meet him," he said. "You must also say, 'Your servant Jacob is right behind us.' Jacob said to himself, I will win him over with the gifts that are being sent ahead, and then I will face him. Hopefully he will forgive me. He sent the gifts ahead of him and spent the night in the camp.
Okay, well done. Okay, what is Yaakov's strategy of this elaborate manner of gift giving? Isn't open bribery insulting?
But not, excuse me, but we have to think of the type of person that Esau is.
Yes.
So correct. For him, I don't think it is insulting. Like, that's his style, you know?
He likes receiving stuff from people because them recognizing him as being the authority.
Yeah.
He likes feel being, you know, like when, like in, just like Rome received tributes from all the other governments, which were what they call vassal states, to the Roman Empire. You know, in other words, Rome was supported by the taxes that were collected in the various countries like Israel and sent back to Rome. So he's got no problem with that. But he doesn't just send all the stuff at one shot. He has a particular strategy of giving out the gifts. What is that?
The gifts are staggered.
I like to call it the Hanukkah strategy. You have kids. You don't want to give them 8 gifts on the first night. But by gift number 2, that gift has a diminishing return of impact. How do you want to give gifts to your kids? How do you want to do it?
It's true. It's exciting, and you build up.
Yeah. Well, you can spread it out. I mean, you may want to start off with a good gift, night one, second gift. You know, you want to mix it up a little bit, keep them off guard. But basically, you definitely don't want to give them all the gifts at one shot because you just get overwhelmed and become like nothing. Okay. So spreading out the gifts over 8 days. Provide psychologically a much greater impact. Similarly, Yaakov, by sending out each cluster of cattle and sheep, cattle and donkeys and all these various goats and rams, etc., into different bundles, and then each servant says, "This belongs to your servant Yaakov." It's a gift, a tribute to my master Esau, and Yaakov is coming right behind. So this is just, you know, very flattering. Okay, let's go on. We do a little Rashi. This is one of the most famous Rashis on the Parsha, but we have to do this one. Okay.
I have a question.
Good.
Does Yaakov have a specific goal other than to not get killed in this? Like, he's not giving up now the rights that he got over lentil soup.
He has one goal, which you said before, that he and his family do not get killed. Second, that they don't lose all their stuff. All the stuff that he had, gathered and amassed over his 20 years with his uncle Lavan, he didn't want to hand it over to Yaakov, to Esau.
Okay.
So, for goal 1, not get killed. Goal 2, not lose all of his wealth. Those are his goals. All right, let's take a look at Rashi. Who could read the Rashi here? Erica, can you read the screen?
Yes, one moment. Okay, then the remaining camp may escape in spite for him, for I will fight against him. He prepared himself for 3 things, to give him a present, as it states. So the present passed before him, for prayer, as it states. And he said, O God of my father Abraham, for war, as it states in this verse, then the remaining camp may escape, for I will fight against him.
Right, so Rashi says that basically there are 3 prongs to Avram's plan, to Yaakov's plan. And they were what? Were the 3 elements?
A present, a prayer, and for war?
Right. Present, prayer, and war. But so the presence, we can call, we can expand, and not just present, really, is a kind of diplomacy, right? Mm-hmm. War is war, military intervention, and prayer is prayer. So the question is, why isn't war alone, or diplomacy alone, or prayer alone a good response to a security crisis? Why does the term show you need to have all three elements?
I mean, all three elements show that he's really looking beyond instant gratification of like safety or an immediate day-to-day plan, but he's looking for what do we do now to resolve this immediately? How are we going to fix this going forward? And what does the future look like?
Well, but it's not really the future. They just want, the goal is to deal with this problem. I mean, they're all these mm-hmm. three elements are basically to solve the problem. They're all three problem solving mechanisms. So the question is, why do you need all three? Why not just have one? Anyone you want. Why not just have diplomacy? Why do you have to have do war? Prepare for war. Why do you have to have prayer? Or just have prayer? Or just diplomacy? Or just war? What Yaakov is doing is really giving us a blueprint of how a Jew should deal with a security crisis.
So there are two players, and Yaakov can only control one of them.
Okay. And therefore what?
So he needs
so God. Depending on how Esau responds, he has to act accordingly.
Okay, so that therefore that would be, that's why you need the war footing, or the diplomacy. Why the prayer?
Because it's not in his control.
So, if it's not in his control, then just pray. So if you're not in control, so pray, and you need to be bailed out, so pray that God will bail you out. Yaakov, who is not only the prophet and has been promised by God to return to the land of Canaan, does not rely on that. Interestingly enough. Basically, the deal is, you see from this, is that a Jew, no matter how great, does not rely upon a miracle. And you have to do everything that you can to control the uncontrollable to the extent that you can. So, as you said, maybe diplomacy will work by buttering him up, by calling himself a slave, by bowing down to him, by sending him gifts. That might work. And if you want war, maybe we'll have to do the divide and flee approach. But the prayer is basically admitting that I, no matter how good of my plans are, I need Hashem's blessing that this should be successful. In other words, Yaakov felt he needed to partner with Hashem to even make any of his plans work. So that's really always a Jew's response. You do your best, and you daven for the rest. And if you don't do your best, that's a lack, because you're basically asking for a miracle. And that's not, Hashem does not give miracles. If you rely upon a miracle, you will not get a miracle, says the Talmud. Okay, we continue. Now I'm going to bring up the famous Midrash, which you may have heard when you went, if you went to Hebrew school, or you may have heard whatever. Let's have this one. All right, so Eric, if you can, all right, Suzanne, this is, so we have the reuniting. Okay, read the pasuk here.
And Esau ran toward him and embraced him, and he fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept.
Okay, so for the plain verse, there was a reuniting. Read the Radak, who's a commentator on the Chumash.
When Esav saw that Yaakov had humbled himself so much before him, he forgave what he had done to him, and his sense of compassion was stirred.
Okay, so basically, the Radak says, based upon the plain text, Yaakov's plan worked. Getting the gifts, bowing down to him seven times, which I skipped that part because we have a limited amount of time, completely worked. And Esav forgave him. And it's all great, and gave him a big hug and a kiss, and they cried. It was we haven't seen each other for 20 years. It was a whole reuniting. It was all fantastic. All right, but there is a story behind the story. Suzanne Bavakasha.
The word has a dot on each of the letters.
Okay, so the Hebrew word is Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. Now, if you look in a Torah, there'll be like a little dot on over above each one of these letters. The Vav, Yud, Shin, Kuf, He, Vav. Go on.
In Reishi Rabbah 78:9, Rabbi Shimon ben Eliezer says that everywhere where you find the dot, do not cover each letter of the word underneath. We give preference to the meaning of the text as is, without the dots. When there are more dots than letters, we give emphasis in our interpretation to the dots. In this instance, there are as many dots as there are letters in the word
Vayishkehu.
Right. Okay, butchered that. So that we understand that Esav kissed Yaakov sincerely with all his heart.
Okay. So Rav Shimon ben Eliezer takes the position that he kissed him in a robust way. Now we have the famous Midrash. Go on.
To this, Rabbi Yanai countered by asking that if this is indeed so, why bother to put any dots on the word if they do not affect the meaning? We therefore must interpret that originally Esav had intended to bite Yaakov's neck, feigning an embrace. God made his teeth as soft as wax and Yaakov's neck as hard as ivory.
In Hebrew it's Vayiv Ku, and they cried. So why were they crying?
One on account of his neck, the other on account of his teeth.
Okay. So Rav Yanai says that the interpretation is that Esav intended to do what to Yaakov's neck?
Bite his
neck. To bite him like a vampire. And what happened?
The prayer worked.
So what happened? What happened to
Esau's
teeth?
They were soft and Yaakov's neck was strong.
Right, so Esau's teeth became like wax and Yaakov's neck became like ivory, you know, like which is tough. Hard. And he goes in there, lunges in there for the bite, and he hurts his teeth. Mm-hmm. Yaakov feels nothing because he has his neck is now like ivory. Okay. I want to learn with you how to learn a midrash. So my first question to you, if you were standing there watching this encounter, tell me, what would you have seen? Describe to me, if you were there, behind the bush, watching Yaakov and Esav embrace. Tell me, play by play, what you have seen, if you were there.
What was written in the verse for?
So you're saying that you see him falling upon his neck, kissing him, and then both crying.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't see his teeth turn to wax, that's for sure.
Right, and would you see anything happen to Yaakov's neck?
No.
No, okay, so step number one, the Midrash are generally not to be taken literally. They're not trying to change the story for you. the Midrash is, in a certain sense, the story behind the story. Okay? So it's a literary device to try and tell you sort of like the what's happening underneath the surface. They're pointing. So my question to you, 11, is according to Rav Yonai, what was the true psychological meaning of Aesop's kiss?
That it was hypocritical.
Okay, what do you mean?
That at first he intended to do him harm, but then he wasn't able to, so then he realized that, like, he kind of, like, surrendered to his brother.
So then what is it, how would you explain his desire to bite him?
Because he wanted to.
How do you go from bite, kiss?
Like betrayal, no? I don't know. Hypocritical.
Hypocritical? So why is he then crying?
Because he feels guilty.
What does he feel guilty about?
Of wanting to do harm to his brother.
Uh-huh. So you're saying he had one psychological force that wanted to injure him. One psychological force that wanted to show love to him. Right?
Right.
And then the love overcame the hatred.
Yes.
And the crying represents a sort of like a sadness about his confused feelings. Is that how you're learning it?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good approach. Anybody want to respond to that?
Maybe he expected Yaakov to also play dirty, and so he was prepared to bite instead of kiss because he assumed Yaakov would do also something not nice. And then when he realized that Yaakov's intention was pure and true, that he felt remorse of, like, he misquestioned his brother.
So you're saying that he initially had aggressive. He felt that, oh, his brother's going to do something bad, so he's going to try to get him. But when he saw mm-hmm. that his brother's not that way, he changed course.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other possibilities you want to lay on the table? Now, I want to go in. This actually reflects a little bit of a sense of what kind of Midrash is sort of painting a portrait, which you guys are alluding to, of what kind of person Aesop is. Aesop is described as a hunter. What qualities do you need to be a good hunter?
Patient.
What?
Patient.
You need to be patient. What else do you need to do?
Highly alert.
Highly alert. Patient. What else?
He wasn't patient when it came to that day when he was very hungry, though.
He was, correct. He was. That's when he was impulsive.
Yeah.
So, but then he was very exhausted. So he lost. He was his guard was down. But he has to, in order to be a good hunter, you need to be cunning. You have to be able to see the behavior of the animal, anticipate it, take advantage of it, and therefore capture it based upon its own weakness. The Midrash says that not only did Aesop hunt animals, he also hunted humans in the sense that he was manipulative. Who, according to the Midrash, another Midrash, who was the object of him manipulating or fooling or tricking? Who was Aesop's interest to fool? Anybody know?
Yaakov?
No. Not Yaakov. He didn't care about. He didn't try to fool Yaakov. Not initially. Really, his interest was his father Yitzchak. Mm-hmm. And when it says that he was Tzayed Befiv. That Yitzchak loved Esav, for he was plain thing is that he gave hunting, provided hunting to him. In other words, Asa fed him delicious delicacies. So therefore, that created a favoritism of Yitzchak to Asa. That's one answer. Another answer is that Yitzchak Afiv, that Asa hunted him with his mouth. In other words, he would say things to Asa, to Yitzchak, that would create, engender a feeling of love and an affection to him. In other words, he tried to trick him into love. Okay? Now, so therefore, that kind of person, this hunter personality, they basically try to find people's weak spots and take advantage of it. So Esav, if he was on his game, would have him going for the bite would define Yaakov's vulnerability and take advantage of it. But there, what happened? He was overwhelmed by the tremendous show of honor and affection to him, and therefore he was knocked off his game. So you could learn the Medrash in that way. In other words, he tried to go bite him in his normal hunting, aggressive way. But he got overwhelmed by the honor and riches that he was shown and the tremendous humility that that Yaakov showed to him. Therefore, it was like Yaakov had received a neck of ivory, protected him from the normal aggressive and insidious manner of Asa. So that you can learn as really the metaphor of the teeth of wax. The teeth of wax was that basically that normally Asaph's teeth are razor sharp and they are generally effective at getting at damaging. But he was overwhelmed by the strategy of honor and gifts and bowing down, and therefore it rendered his normal skills into wax. He became soft, not effective. Yaakov, who's normally not able to deal with a guy like Asaph, he was uplifted to be like a guy who had tremendous skills, like as if he had a neck of ivory. Now, bringing this back to Israel, how does Israel deal with Hamas' desire to bite them? What do they do?
They defend themselves with a neck of ivory.
Okay, so give me different features of their neck of ivory. What are some of the practical things that...
Iron Dome.
Number one, Iron Dome. Iron Dome is their neck of ivory, number one. What's number two? What else do they do? Again, these are things that we know about. Obviously, going to be things that we do not know about.
Preemptive strikes.
They do some preemptive strikes, like we talked about knocking out the
leadership.
Head of Islamic Jihad. What else? They also work out, they try to block the tunnels. They try to investigate to find the tunnels, the terror tunnels, that Hamas always is building into the mainland of Israel to be able to attack. And they always are constantly investigate by the sea to make sure that there's no encroaching of from Gaza into the land of Israel. Now, we've mentioned in this class, and certainly in the senior fellowship, of the strategy and the ideology of Zev Jabotinsky. Can anybody summarize what Zev Jabotinsky's philosophy, ideology, which, by the way, is the ideology of the right wing parties in Israel? Can anybody share with me Zev Jabotinsky's ideology, specifically his principle of the Iron Wall? Anybody remember that? All right, so I will share that with you. So Zev Jabotinsky died, actually, ironically, in Hunter Mountain, 1940, who started Beitar. He had the following principle. The cause of anti-Semitism is Jewish powerlessness. Therefore, a Jew needs to learn how to defend themselves. A Jew needs to learn how to shoot a gun. And therefore, if they have a country, they need to have an army. Not just an army, they need to be able to have an army that will create an iron wall against their enemies. That the wall will be so strong that the enemies will give up trying to destroy Israel and will then have to cut a deal. Okay? But basically, they have to make it clear that Israel is not going to disappear. Israel is not going to go away. When they see that and that there's nothing they can do to change that, that is the iron wall. So conversely, how is Jabotinsky's ideology, which is the ideology of the right-wing parties in Israel, like Yaakov's neck of ivory?
So about trades and okay. Power.
Yeah, Esther, go on.
just not letting. Sorry, I'm getting over a cold. Not letting the enemy penetrate you.
Exactly. Basically, creating a unyielding counterforce to your enemy. Or it's just like Yaakov, either by the help of God or Yaakov's own ingenuity, creating a situation where he could not be bit. Conversely, the goal of the State of Israel and the IDF is to create an environment where the people of Israel are not harmed by Hamas. Now, question 16 is, what aspects of Yaakov's strategy does Israel need to add to the Iron Wall approach? What historic occurrences underlie Israel's reluctance to incorporate these aspects of Yaakov's strategy? What part of Yaakov's strategy do they do? What do they need to add?
Well, they don't do the flattery part, but I don't know that they need to.
Well, flattery is just one tool of diplomacy. It's a kind of diplomacy. So this, of course, is the big debate in Israel. In other words, how much diplomacy and how much military might. Every sophisticated country, like the United States, has the military, Air Force, Marines, Navy, right? And also the State Department. The State Department is basically the diplomatic corps. The goal is try to negotiate problems before they become military problems. But you need to have a military to know that if you're going to mess around with us, we do have the capacity to wipe you out. So similarly, that balance between the diplomacy and the military is something that's not been resolved in Israel. And not to mention the tefillah. There are many people that, of course, daven for the soldiers. The soldiers themselves daven. But how much tefillah? Certainly no national tefillah. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Because the State of Israel is officially a secular state. Now, what is so difficult about this Hamas-IDF conflict? Why is the situation very much like the Esav-Yaakov problem?
Diplomacy doesn't work with them, so that takes out one.
Well, so here's the question. Let me share with you. I don't know if you've heard about this, but the new director, the new Minister of Defense, Naftali Bennett, has shared the possibility of having this seaport off the coast of Gaza, which would be like, you know, a half a kilometer off the, which you can just create a road based on a pier, where then they could go out sufficiently further out in the Mediterranean, and therefore they can get cargo. Now that could be used as a bargaining chip. You want to have your enclave of Gaza has 50% unemployment rate. People are struggling. In other words, if Hamas does not solve the misery of their people, what could happen to them? What happens to tyrants and despots that do not take care of their people sufficiently enough?
The people rebel against them.
The people rebel against them. So they can get killed or knocked out by Israel. I mean, by their own people. So they have to keep the people, quote unquote, relatively happy. So therefore, there has to be some carrots. It just can't be sticks. So what Israel, even though that the charter of Hamas is that they are committed to the destruction of the state of Israel, but they're also more committed to what? The non-destruction of Hamas. this becomes a very delicate challenge of the balance between war, I mean military, diplomacy, and tefillah. In other words, that's why they shot 190 rockets. Israel bombed certain installations of, they didn't bomb every place. They didn't carpet bomb the place. They bombed the Islamic Jihad places, by and large. So there's a very tenuous balance. The problem is, it can't be, in other words, after Yaakov hugged and kissed Esav, right? What did Esav say to him? This is great. What should we? What suggestion did Esav make to Yaakov? Well, we should go together. Now that we are the two brothers have made up, we should go. We should spend time together. Which in turn Yaakov said, "Look, I can't keep up with you guys. You go up ahead. If I push the flock too much, they will die. You go up ahead. I'll catch you." Oh, no problem. Should I leave some men with you? You know, to help you guys out? No, not necessary. You keep on going. So basically, even though that Yaakov had successfully neutralized this encounter, he knew that this can fall back into a disaster in one day. Therefore, he did not want to spend any more time with Esau. You go up ahead. I'll be right behind you. Now, did Yaakov ever get to where Esav was? Did he ever go visit him in Har Seir in modern-day Jordan? No, he did not. He did not go visit him. He let him go and sayonara. So, in dealing with their implacable foe Hamas. Not to mention Hezbollah and Iran and all the other ones, it's a very careful chess game, utilizing military, like bombing of various things, but not too much to get a full-scale war, but enough to make it miserable enough that they're not going to go more, and also try to dangle some presence, if you will, allowing more permits to work in Israel. Allowing hospitals to be built in the Erez crossing and the Rafah crossing, allowing for a seaport to perhaps be built off the coast of Gaza, so therefore there'd be more employment and more trade. So they're trying both the carrot and the stick, and those people who believe in prayer also davening that for the we at MJE and nearly every shul in the world prays for all the men and women who work courageously in the Israeli Defense Forces, as well as for the safety and security and success of the State of Israel. But you have to have a multi-tiered approach. You got to be ready for war. You got to have that iron dome, and you got to have the iron wall. You got to do your diplomatic, whatever is the best, and which is not so simple. And in fact, there's no agreement in Israel what the best course of action is. And third, you have to do your best. And lastly, you got to daven for the rest. And that really is, that's why going back full circle, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, when he analyzed, he didn't just read through the story. He would analyze the story of how Yaakov took great care in his chess-like encounter with Esau. So too, when he would read this story carefully, it would get him into that chess-like strategic game face, if you will, to be able to deal with, you know, Mark Antony, Antoninus of, you know, the Caesar of Rome, to be able to make sure that the Jewish people will be put into the best possible circumstance. And that's the problem. All of us are going to go through difficult parts of our lives, and we have to take a multi-pronged approach. We have to do everything we can diplomatically, you know, in this case, militarily, and lastly, in prayer, to daven that our plan, that is a good, thoughtful plan, should be successful. Any questions, anyone?
No.
All right. Have a great night. I'll see a number of you guys tomorrow night at MJE. All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.